6.
This individual says he's acquainted with you,
the small blonde barfly explained to Hamilton.
That's right,
Hamilton answered. Pull up a stool and sit down. He eyed Laws levelly. Have you investigated the situation with advanced physics in the last day or so?
The hell with physics,
Laws said, scowling.
I'm past that. I've outgrown that.
Go construct a reservoir, Hamilton told him. Stop reading so many books. Get out in the fresh air. Laws placed his lean hand on the blonde's shoulder.
Meet Grace. Full of reservoir. Full to the gills.
Glad to meet you, Hamilton said. The girl smiled uncertainly.
My name isn't Grace. My name...
Pushing the girl aside, Laws leaned close to Hamilton.
I'm glad you mentioned the term reservoir.
Why?
Because,
Laws informed him,
in this world there is no such thing.
But there has to be.
Come along.
Holding on to Hamilton's necktie, Laws pulled him away from the bar.
I'm going to let you in on something. Greatest discovery since the poll tax.
Threading his way among the patrons, Laws led Hamilton to the cigarette dispenser in the corner. Thumping the machine with the flat of his hand, Laws said triumphantly,
Well, what do you think of it?
Hamilton cautiously examined the machine. The usual sight, a tall metallic box with blue-tinted mirror, coin slots at the upper right, rows of little glass windows behind which rested various brands of cigarettes, the line of levers, and then the drop slot. Looks all right, he commented.
Notice anything about it?
No, nothing in particular. Laws peered around to make certain no one was listening. Then he dragged Hamilton close to him.
I've been watching that machine work,
he whispered harshly.
I figured out something. Try to grasp this. Try not to get thrown. There are no cigarettes in that machine.
Hamilton considered. None at all? Squatting down, Laws indicated the row of display packages visible behind their glass covering.
That's all there is. One of each. There is no reservoir. But watch.
He dropped a quarter into the coin slot, selected the camel's lever, and pushed it firmly in. A package of camels slid out, and Laws grabbed it.
See?
I don't get it, Hamilton admitted.
The candy bar machine is the same.
Laws led him over to the candy dispensing machine.
Candy comes out, but there's no candy in it. Only the display packages. Get it? Comprehend?
No.
Didn't you ever read about miracles? In the desert it was getting food and water. That's what came first.
Oh, Hamilton said. That's right.
These machines work on the original principle, division by miracle.
From his pocket, Laws got a screwdriver. Kneeling, he began disassembling the candy bar machine.
I tell you, Jack, this is the greatest discovery known to man. This will revolutionize modern industry. The whole concept of machine tool production, the whole assembly line technique.
Laws waved his hand.
Out. Kaput. No more using up raw materials, no more depressed labor force, no more dirty pounding factories. In this metal box lies a vast secret.
Hey, Hamilton said, interested. Maybe you've got something.
This stuff can be utilized.
Feverishly, Laws tore at the back of the machine.
Give me a hand, man. Help me get the lock off.
The lock came off. Between them, the two men slid the back of the candy dispenser away and leaned it against the wall. As Laws had predicted, the upright columns that were the reservoirs of the machine were totally empty.
Get a dime out,
Laws instructed. Skillfully, he unbolted the inner mechanism until the display bars were visible from behind. To the right was the output chute. At its beginning was an elaborate series of stages, levers, and wheels. Laws began tracing the physical circuit back to its point of origin.
Looks like the candy bar starts here, Hamilton suggested.
Leaning over Laws's shoulder, he touched a flat shelf. The coin trips a switch and tilts that plunger over. It gives the candy bar a shove and starts it moving toward the slot. Gravity does the rest.
Put the coin in,
Laws said urgently.
I want to see where the damn candy bar comes from.
Hamilton inserted a dime and pulled a plunger at random. The wheels and levers spun. From the center of the grinding works emerged a Unobar. The Unobar slithered down the chute and came to a rest in the slot outside the machine.
It just grew out of nothing,
Laws said, awed. But in a specific area,
It appeared tangent to the model bar. That suggests it's a kind of binary fission process. The model bar splits into two whole bars.
Drop another dime in. I tell you, Jack, this is it.
Again, a candy bar materialized and was expelled by the efficient machinery. Both men watched with admiration.
A neat piece of equipment,
Claus admitted.
A lovely job of designing and construction. Fine utilization of the miracle principle.
But utilization on a small scale, Hamilton pointed out. For candy, soft drinks, and cigarettes, nothing important.
That's where we come in.
Gingerly, Laws pushed a bit of tinfoil into the empty stage beside a model Hershey bar. The tinfoil met no resistance.
Nothing there, all right. If I take out the model bar and put something else in its place...
Hamilton removed the model Hershey bar and placed a bottle cap in the display rack. When the lever was pulled, a duplicate bottle cap rustled down the chute and out the exit slot.
That proves it,
Laws agreed.
It duplicates anything tangent to it. We could duplicate anything.
He got out some silver coins.
Let's get down to business.
How does this sound? Hamilton said. An old electronic principle, regeneration. We feed part of the output back to the original model stage, so the supply continues to build. The more it turns out, the more is fed back and duplicated.
A liquid would be best,
Claus reflected.
Where can we get some glass tubing to pipe it back?
Hamilton tore down a neon display from the wall, while Laws trotted to the bar to order a drink. As Hamilton was installing the tubing, Laws reappeared, carrying a tiny glass of amber liquid.
Brandy,
Laws explained.
Genuine French cognac, the best they have.
Hamilton pushed the glass onto the model stage where the Hershey bar had been. The tubing, emptied of its neon gas, led from the tangent duplication area and divided. One nozzle led back to the original glass. The other led to the output slot.
The ratio is 4-1,
Hamilton commented.
4 parts go out the slot as product. 1 part is fed back to the original source. Theoretically, we should get an ever-accelerating output, with infinite volume as a limit.
With a deft motion, Laws wedged open the lever that tripped the mechanism into action. After a pause, cognac began dripping from the slot onto the floor in front of the machine. Getting to his feet, Laws grabbed up the detached back of the machine. The two men fitted it into place and turned the lock. Quietly, continuously, the candy dispenser drizzled a growing torrent of top-quality brandy.
That's it, Hamilton said, pleased. 3 drinks. Everybody line up.
A few bar patrons shambled over, interested. Very shortly, there was a crowd.
We've utilized the machinery,
Laws said slowly as the two of them stood watching the growing line that had formed in front of the ex-candy dispenser.
But we haven't worked out the basic principle. We know what it does and mechanistically how, but not why.
Maybe, Hamilton conjectured, there isn't any principle. Isn't that what miracle means? No operating law, just a capricious event, without regularity or cause? It simply happens. You can't predict or trace back a source.
But there's regularity here,
Laws insisted, indicating the candy machine.
When the dime is put in, a candy bar comes out, not a baseball or a toad. And that's all natural law is, simply a description of what happens, an account of regularity. There's no causality involved. We merely say that if A and B are added, we get C and not D.
Will we always get C?
Hamilton asked.
Maybe and maybe not. So far we've got C. We've got candy bars. And now it's turning out brandy, not insect spray. We have our regularity, our pattern. All we have to do is find out what elements are necessary to make up the pattern.
Excitedly, Hamilton said, if we can find out what has to be present to cause duplication of the model object...
Right. Something sets the process into motion. We don't care how it does it. All we have to do is know what does it. We don't need to know how sulfur, potassium, nitrate, and charcoal produce gunpowder, or even why. All we have to know is that when mixed together in a certain proportion, they do.
The two of them moved back toward the bar, past the throng of patrons collecting the free brandy.
Then this world does have laws, Hamilton said. Like our own. I mean, not like our own, but laws, anyhow.
A dark shadow passed over Bill Laws's face.
That's so.
Suddenly his enthusiasm was gone.
I forgot.
What's wrong?
It won't work back in our world. It'll only work here.
Oh, Hamilton said, mollified. True.
We're wasting our time.
Unless we don't want to go back.
At the bar, Laws seated himself on a stool and gathered up his shot glass.
Hunched over, brooding, he murmured,
Maybe that's what we ought to do. Stay here.
Sure,
McFaith said genially, overhearing him.
Stay here. Be smart. Quit while you're ahead.
Laws glanced briefly at Hamilton.
You want to stay here? You like it here?
No, Hamilton said.
Neither do I. But maybe we don't have a choice. As yet, we don't even know where we are. And as far as getting out...
This is a nice place,
the little blonde barfly said indignantly.
I'm here all the time, and I think it's fine.
We're not talking about the bar, Hamilton said. His hands gripped harshly around his shot glass. Laws said,
We're going to have to get back. Somehow we're going to have to find our way out of here.
I realize that, Hamilton said.
You know what you can buy at the supermarket?
Laws inquired acidly.
I'll tell you. Canned burnt offerings.
You know what you can buy at the hardware store?
Hamilton answered.
Scales to weight your soul on.
That's silly,
the blonde said petulantly.
A soul doesn't have any weight.
Then, Hamilton reflected, you could put one through the U.S. mail for nothing.
How many souls,
Laws conjectured ironically,
can be fitted into one stamped envelope? New religious question. Split mankind in half. Warring factions. Blood running in the gutters.
10, Hamilton guessed.
14,
Laws contradicted.
Heretic. Baby-murdering monster.
Bestial drinker of unpurified blood.
A cursed spawn of filth-devouring evil.
Laws considered.
You know what you can get on your TV set Sunday morning? I won't tell you. You can find out for yourself.
Carefully holding his empty shot glass, he slid abruptly from his stool and disappeared into the crowd.
Hey, Hamilton said, astonished. Where'd he go?
He's crazy,
the blonde said, matter-of-factly. For a moment, the figure of Bill Laws reappeared. His dark face was gray with anguish. Addressing Hamilton across the murmuring, laughing crowd of patrons, he shouted,
Jack, you know what?
What?
Hamilton answered, perturbed. The Negro's face twitched in a spasm of acute, helpless misery.
In this world?
Sorrow blurred his eyes.
In this damn place, I've started to shuffle.
He was gone, leaving Hamilton to ponder.
What did he mean?
The blonde asked curiously.
Shuffle cards?
Shuffle him,
Hamilton murmured moodily.
They all do,
McFaith commented. Taking Bill Laws' vacated stool, the blonde began systematically oozing up to Hamilton.
Buy me a drink, baby,
she asked hopefully. I can't.
Why not? Underage?
Hamilton searched his empty pocket.
I haven't got any money. I spent it on that candy machine.
Pray,
McFaith told him.
Pray like hell.
Dear Lord, Hamilton said bitterly, send your unworthy electronics expert a glass of colored water for this tarnished young baggage.
Dutifully, he concluded,
Amen.
A glass of colored water appeared on the surface of the bar beside his elbow. Smiling, the girl accepted it.
You're sweet. What's your name?
Jack.
What's your full name?
He sighed.
Jack Hamilton.
My name's Silky.
Playfully, she toyed with his collar.
Is that your Ford coupe out there?
Sure, he answered dully.
Let's go someplace. I hate this place. Here, I...
Why? Hamilton lashed out suddenly and loudly. Why the hell did God answer that prayer? Why not some of the others? Why not Bill Laws's?
God approved of your prayer, Silky said. After all, it's up to him. He has to decide how he feels about it.
That's terrible.
Silky shrugged.
Maybe so.
How can you live with that? You never know what's going to happen. There's no order, no logic.
It infuriated him that she did not object, that it seemed natural to her.
We're helpless. We have to depend on whim. It keeps us from being people. We're like animals waiting to be fed, rewarded or punished.
Silky studied him.
You're a funny boy.
I'm 32 years old, I'm not a boy, and I'm married.
Fondly, the girl tugged at his arm, half pulling him from his precarious stool.
Come on, baby, let's go where we can worship in private. I have a few rituals you might like to try.
Will I go to hell for it?
Not if you know the right people.
My new boss has an intercom to heaven. Will that do?
Sophie continued to urge him from his stool.
We'll talk about it later. Let's go before that ape of an Irishman notices.
Raising his head, McFaith eyed Hamilton. In a strained, hesitant voice, he said,
Are you leaving?
Sure,
Hamilton said, getting unsteadily from his stool.
Wait,
McFaith followed after him.
Don't leave.
Take care of your own soul,
Hamilton said. But he caught in McFaith's face the element of basic uncertainty.
What's the matter?
He asked, sobered.
McFaith said,
I want to show you something.
Show me what?
Striding past Hamilton and Silky, McFaith picked up an immense black umbrella. He turned back to them, waiting. Hamilton followed, and Silky tagged along. Pushing the doors open, McFaith carefully raised the vast, tent-like umbrella over their heads. The light sprinkle had become a shower. Cold aluminum rain beat down on the shiny sidewalks, on the silent stores and streets. Silky shivered.
It's dismal. Where are we going?
Locating Hamilton's coupe in the gloom, McFaith was saying to himself in a monotone,
It must still exist.
Why do you suppose he shuffled?
Hamilton asked morbidly, as the car raced along the endless wet highway.
He never shuffled before.
Behind the wheel, McFaith drove reflexively, his body hunched, sunk down so that he seemed almost asleep.
Like I said,
he muttered, rousing himself,
they're that way.
It means something,
Hamilton persisted. The swish-swish of the windshield wipers lulled him. He lay sleepily against Silky and closed his eyes. The girl smelled faintly of cigarette smoke and perfume. A good smell. He enjoyed it. Against his cheek, her hair was dry, light, scratchy, like certain weed spores. McFaith said,
You know this second Bab stuff?
His voice lifted, desperate and harsh.
It's a lot of hot air. A nut cult. A bunch of crackpots. It's nothing but a bunch of Arabs coming over here with their ideas. Isn't that right?
Neither Hamilton nor Silky answered.
It won't last,
McFaith said. Peevishly, Silky said,
I want to know where we're going.
Squeezing closer to Hamilton, she said,
Are you really married?
Ignoring her, Hamilton said to McFaith, I know what you're afraid of.
I'm not afraid of anything,
McFaith said.
You sure are,
Hamilton said, and he too, in spite of himself, was uneasy. Ahead of them, San Francisco grew larger and closer, until the car was passing between houses and along streets which showed no sign of life, no motion or sound or light. McFaith seemed to know exactly where he wished to go. He made turn after turn, until the car was moving along narrow side streets. Suddenly he slowed the car. Raising himself up, he peered through the windshield. His face was stiff with apprehension.
This is awful,
Silky complained, burying her head in Hamilton's coat.
What is this slum? I don't get it.
Stopping the car, McFaith pushed the door open and stepped out onto the empty street. Hamilton followed him, and the two of them stood together. Silky stayed behind, listening to insipid dinner music on the car radio. The tinny sound drifted out into the darkness, mixing with the fog that drifted among the closed-up stores and hulking, shabby buildings.
Is that it? Hamilton asked at last.
Yeah,
McFaith nodded. Now, faced with the reality of it, he showed no emotion. The two men faced a dingy, run-down store, a decrepit board structure, whose yellow paint had peeled away, exposing the rain-soaked wood beneath. Heaps of trash and newspapers littered the entrance. By the light of the street lamp, Hamilton made out the notices pasted on the windows. Cracked, yellow and fly-specked, were smeared and arranged haphazardly. Beyond was a dingy curtain, and past that, rows of ugly metal chairs. Behind the chairs, the interior of the store was in darkness. Erected above the entrance of the store was a hand-lettered sign, aged and tattered. It read, Non-Babaist Church. All welcome. With a ragged groan, McFaith pulled himself together and started toward the sidewalk.
Better let it go, Hamilton said, following.
No,
McSafe shook his head.
I'm going in.
Raising his black umbrella, he stepped up to the entrance of the store. In a moment, he was hammering methodically on the door with the umbrella handle. The sound echoed up and down the empty street, a hollow, vacant noise. Somewhere in an alley, an animal stirred among the ash cans, startled. The man who eventually opened the door a crack was a tiny, bent figure. Timidly, he peeped out through a pair of steel-rimmed glasses. His cuffs were threadbare and unclean. His yellow, watery eyes darted warily. Trembling, he gazed without recognition at McSafe.
"What do you want?"
he quavered in a thin, whining voice.
"Don't you know me?" McSafe said. "What's happened, Father? Where's the church?"
Fumbling, muttering, the dried-up old man began to tug the door shut.
"Get away from here, a couple of good-for-nothing drunks. Get away or I'll call the police."
As the door swung shut, McSafe stuck his umbrella into the opening, jamming it.
"Father," he implored, "this is terrible. I can't understand it. They stole your church, and you're small. It isn't possible."
His voice ebbed, broken with disbelief.
"You used to be..."
He turned helplessly to Hamilton.
"He used to be big, bigger than me."
"Get away,"
the little creature buzzed warningly.
"Can't we come in?"
McSafe asked, making no move to take away his umbrella.
"Please let us in. Where else can we go? I have a heretic here. He wants to be converted."
The little man hesitated. Grimacing anxiously, he peered out at Hamilton.
"You? What's the matter? Can't you come back tomorrow? It's after midnight. I was sound asleep."
Releasing the door, he stepped reluctantly aside.
"This is all there is,"
McSafe said to Hamilton as the two of them entered.
"Did you ever see it before? It was made of stone, big as..."
He gestured futilely.
"The biggest of them all."
"It'll cost you $10,
the little man said ahead of them. Bending down, he lugged a clay urn from under the counter. On the counter were heaps of tracts and pamphlets. Several slid to the floor, but he didn't notice.
"In advance,"
he added. Fumbling in his pockets, McSafe gazed about him.
"Where's the organ and the candles? Don't you even have candles?"
"Can't afford that sort of business,"
the little man said, scurrying toward the rear.
"Now just what is it that you want?
You want me to convert this heretic?"
He caught hold of Hamilton's arm and scrutinized him.
"I'm Father O'Farrell. You'll have to kneel down, young man, and bow your head."
Hamilton said, "Has it always been like this?" Momentarily pausing, Father O'Farrell said,
"Like what? What do you mean?"
A wave of compassion touched Hamilton.
"Let it go,"
he said.
"Our organization is very old,"
Father O'Farrell told him hesitantly.
"Is that what you mean? It goes back centuries."
His tone wavered.
"Back before even the first Bab. I'm not positive of the exact date of origin. They say it's..."
He faltered.
"We don't have much authority. The first Bab, of course, that was 1844, but even before that..."
"I want to talk to God," Hamilton said.
"Yes, yes,"
Father O'Farrell agreed.
"So do I, young man."
He patted Hamilton's arm. The pressure was light, almost unfelt.
"So does everybody."
"Can't you help me?" Hamilton said.
"It's very difficult,"
Father O'Farrell said. He disappeared into a back closet, a chaotic storeroom. Wheezing and groping, he reappeared carrying a wicker basket of assorted bones, fragments, bits of dried hair and skin.
"This is everything we've got,"
he gasped, setting the basket down.
"Maybe you can get some use out of these. You're welcome to help yourself."
As Hamilton gingerly lifted a few pieces out, McSafe said in a shattered voice,
"Look at them. Phonies. Junk curios."
"We do what we can,"
Father O'Farrell said, pressing his hands together. Hamilton said, "Is there any way we can get up there?" For the first time, Father O'Farrell smiled.
"You'd have to be dead, young man."
Gathering up his umbrella, McSafe moved toward the door.
"Let's go,"
he said heavily to Hamilton.
"Let's get out of here. I've had enough."
"Wait," Hamilton said. Halting, McSafe asked,
"Why do you want to talk to God? What good will it do? You can see the situation. Look around."
Hamilton said, "He's the only one who can tell us what's happened." After a pause, McSafe said,
I don't care what's happened. I'm leaving.
Working rapidly, Hamilton laid out a circle of bones and teeth, a ring of relics.
Give me a hand,
he said to McSafe.
You're in this too. What you're after,
McSafe said,
is a miracle.
I know, Hamilton said. McSafe walked back.
It won't do any good. It's hopeless.
He stood gripping his great black umbrella. Father O'Farrell paced about restlessly, bewildered by what was happening.
I want to know how this business got started, Hamilton said. This second bab, this whole mess. If I can't find out there.
Reaching, he seized the great black umbrella from McSafe and, taking a deep breath, raised it. Like the spread of a leathery vulture, the struts and fabric of the umbrella opened above him. A few drops of stagnant moisture dripped down.
What's this?
McSafe demanded, stepping just past the circle of relics to grope for his umbrella.
Grab on.
Holding tightly to the handle of the umbrella, Hamilton said to Father O'Farrell,
Is there water in that jug?
Yes,
Father O'Farrell said, peering into an earthenware urn.
Some, at the bottom.
As you toss the water, Hamilton said, recite that upgoing part.
Upgoing?
Perplexed, Father O'Farrell retreated.
I...
Et resurrexit, you remember.
Oh,
Father O'Farrell said.
Yes, I believe so.
Nodding, he dubiously dipped his hand into the urn of holy water and began sprinkling it onto the umbrella.
I sincerely doubt if this will work.
Recite, Hamilton ordered. Uncertainly, Father O'Farrell murmured,
Et resurrexit tertia die secundum scripturas, et ascendit in celum, sed et ad dexteram partis, et iterum venerus, et cum gloria judicare vivus et mortuos, cuias regni non erit finis.
In Hamilton's hands the umbrella quivered. Gradually, laboriously, it began to ascend. McSafe gave a terrified bleat and hung on for his life. In a moment, the tip of the umbrella was bumping against the low ceiling of the store. Hamilton and McSafe dangled absurdly, their feet waving in the dusty shadows.
The skylight, Hamilton gasped. Open it.
Rushing to get the pole, Father O'Farrell scurried about like a disturbed mouse. The skylight was pushed aside. Wet night air billowed in, displacing the staleness of years. Released, the umbrella shot upward. The tumble-down wooden building disappeared below. Cold fog plucked at Hamilton and McSafe as they rose higher and higher. Now they were level with Twin Peaks. Now they were above the great city of San Francisco, suspended by the handle of the umbrella over a dish of winking yellow light.
What?
McSafe shouted.
What if we let go?
Pray for strength, Hamilton shouted back, closing his eyes and clutching frantically at the shaft of the umbrella. Up and up the umbrella shot, gaining velocity each instant. For a brief interval, Hamilton dared to open his eyes and peer upward. Above lay a limitless expanse of ominous black clouds. What existed beyond? Was he waiting? Up and up rose the umbrella into the dark night. It was too late to back out now.